Robbie Humble, our speaker today, holds a BA Honors in International Development Studies from the University of Regina. Robbie believes in the importance of placing ourselves in the global context to understand how we have benefited from and are implicated in global justice issues. She believes that when we work together through venues which help us see our common humanity, where everyone is encouraged to understand their responsibilities as global citizens, we can create the world we want to see instead of the one that has been created for us. She has been educating herself to understand more about her own role in the global systems of injustice, and that led her to Guatemala. There, she participated in a solidarity tour to learn about human rights violations and environmental degradation at the hands of Canadian mining companies, and to build north-south relationships rooted in solidarity. In her day job, she is thankful to be able to work as the communications officer for the Saskatchewan Council for International Cooperation. Robbie.
Thank you very much, Helen. I forgot that you had asked me to write that intro, so that actually does a lot of my intro for me, so that's exciting. So would anyone here be shocked to know that 75% of the world's mining companies are registered in Canada? That was something that definitely, caught my eye. And mining is often seen as, obviously very environmentally devastating. And when I started to learn more about that and realize that we were big players in this, I wanted to to dig a little bit deeper. And as Helen said, that sort of question led me to participate in this solidarity tour to Guatemala. And so I'm going to be sharing a little bit about what I learned there. While I was there, we met with four different communities. Primarily, they were Indigenous communities, and all of them were struggling against Canadian mining operations or American operations, or ones that had been, are jointly owned. To start off, like I said, the environment is one of the biggest concerns. And when we look at the struggles that have been going on and a lot of the conflicts that have happened, mostly they start at the environment level. And so, the readings and the songs that we had this morning are very applicable to that, especially when we're talking about the Indigenous communities. Guatemala has a majority Indigenous population, and so the earth and the environment are very, very important. And so you can start to see that once the environment is degraded, a lot of the conflicts start. So just a little bit of a context of that, or these are some of the regions I'll be talking about, just to give you a sense of that. So the first one I want to talk about is the Goldcorp mine, which is in the top left there, and that's near the Mexican border. And the ones with gray are the ones that I visited, but these red are other mining conflicts, and this is not an exhaustive list by any means. So this is what the Goldcorp Marlin mine looks like. One aspect of it, this is a very sprawling mine. And what they're doing here is open pit mining as well as tunneling. And so in the process, they essentially blow up a mountaintop, right? And through that process, there's a lot of naturally occurring chemicals and carcinogens that are released, such as lead, mercury, and arsenic, as well as the chemicals that are used in the processing to separate, this is a gold mine, so it's to separate the gold and other precious metals from a lot of the other material. And to think of the scale of this, it takes about 7 tons of raw material to extract 1 ounce of gold. So the massive amounts of earth that they're moving is just astronomical. So just keep this image in mind as I want to give you a little bit of a scale first. So this is that pit from afar. And then just around the corner. And then even further back, this is a picture of me standing in front of one of the second pits. And you can see that other pit in the distance there. And the communities that are struggling against this mine are kind of sprinkled in and throughout. And Goldcorp is basically just expanding and expanding around the people. And so, again, this is just to give you a little bit of the scale. Water is of course a major part of the environmental concerns. This operation, and this is by Goldcorp's estimates, goes through 22.5 million liters of water per day to process, and for all of the industrial processes. And because of the explosions that it takes to blow up the mountain, the communities suffer a lot of, you know, cracked houses and things like that. So these are some of the base environmental concerns that really start to that cause the basis of concern. As well, when I talk about the water, this is the Goldcorp's one of their tailings ponds. I don't know if it's the biggest. It was the biggest that we saw. If you can see that little red dot in the bottom, that's a truck. So you can see the scale of this again, and those are obviously buildings in the background. And this is essentially a valley that they're basically filling up with the wastewater. And in this particular site, they've said that there is no sort of barrier between the water and the earth. They've apparently have claimed that, you know, they've done a study and the geology of the area is allowing for some sort of natural filtration process. But when you're, you know, that we here understand about how everything is connected, right? And so when you're thinking about very, very toxic chemicals next to communities, you know, you'd want to, if I was living there, I would want to, at the very least, be seeing a barrier between the chemicals and my land, right? And one of the ways that, you know, land is a central issue, and one of the ways that it's really, I guess one of the difficulties is that when the companies come into the area, a common story that we heard across the communities is that often they buy up land under false pretenses. So if you'll see this, the next mine I want to talk about is operated by Tahoe Resources. So this is the one that's down in the bottom left. The mine site is called El Escobal. And this is another one. This is their tailings pond there. And right next door, you'll see that those are tomatoes for export. And this is primarily a farming community. And so what they'll do is they come in and they buy up land under false pretenses, like I said. So, you know, there'll be a group of people that come in and say they want to, you know, start a farm to develop some experimental trees or different types of crops. And slowly they'll buy plot by plot. And the next thing you know, they're building this massive industrial process. And so one of the things that we heard is that through Tahoe's reports and things, they often you know, quell the concerns of their shareholders by saying, you know, this is very far away from people. It's not close to populations, but this is us standing on a farm that is directly bordering the mine. When you're standing here, you can hear the process is going 24 hours a day. You know, you talk about people that are concerned about noise pollution from windmills, right? Here you have that noise pollution, but you also have the intermittent blasts as well as the water issues that are being faced in the other communities as well. And the way that the issue of the land being bought up under false pretenses really extends into a lot of how the social divisions start happening in the communities. And so, you know, some members will be very upset that their neighbors sold their land, but at a certain point, you know, the people will recognize that the company is making a lot of money for this, so they'll start to at least charge more for their land. And so the community members have often get very upset with their neighbors who have sold after they've understood that this is a mine, because it allows them to expand, and it eventually puts a lot of pressure on the other people who are holding out. And this is where you start to see a lot of violence. And in this community, in San Rafael Las Flores, where the Tahoe mine is operating, there's been so much violence. Semi-recently, in the last year or so, there was a 16-year-old activist who was shot and killed. And often this is by other members of the community or people who have started working for the mine, because they create these divisions. And her father was also injured in the attack. And both of them were well known for trying to campaign against the mine, for organizing community votes, which have been happening across Guatemala. There's been hundreds of community votes, almost all of which have said, we don't want these mines in our communities. And in the Tahoe mine area as well, there's a lot of fear and intimidation that happens. While we were there, we were meeting with community leaders who were trying to organize against the mine. And even while we were there, we had security trucks that were tailing us around the community. Now, we knew that we were relatively safe. You know, we're foreign visitors. You know, there'd probably be some problems with the consulate if anything happened to us. But thinking about the fact of when we left, how the people that we were meeting with, how they would feel that this is what they're going through every single day. This is one of the people that we met with. His name is Eric Castillo, and he was shot by mine security personnel during a peaceful protest along with six other men. And this case is actually one that's finally starting. It's going to be heard in Canadian courts. And this is a precedent-setting thing. This is a case from Guatemalan citizens against a parent company in Canada for what their personnel in Guatemala have done. And this is the second such case which has finally advanced to Canadian courts. And it hasn't gone through any sort of significant process yet. It's a major step forward, because one of the biggest issues when a lot of this social conflict is happening is the companies can often claim, you know, there's a lot of jurisdiction issues. Oh, it's not us, it's our subsidiary. Oh, it's Guatemalan laws, it's not our laws, right? And often they hide behind that too. When there's conflicts that happen, they sell off their assets, right? And they wash their hands of it. And so this is one of the first steps toward seeking some justice for that, although it's just definitely a long road to go. But meanwhile, Eric is still living in this community. He, you know, when we saw that there was mine security following us, I felt like I was in a drug movie. Like, we had to, you know, he sent someone else to meet us so that they would think we were meeting someone else, and then finally he felt safe to come forward to actually meet with us, to show us around the community. And so when you start to understand that immediate fear, it starts to kind of put this all into perspective about what this means. And this one in particular is primarily a Ladino community, so people of Spanish heritage or Spanish and Indigenous heritage. These issues, though, are a lot worse when you start to look at Indigenous communities, and I think that can be said for basically around the world, but Guatemala is no different. So the next struggle I want to talk about is the Phoenix Project, which is in the top right. It's kind of in the more of the tropical region. And this is one, this is the other one that the case has advanced to Canadian courts, or will be advancing, because of the company Hudbay. That's the company that's in the case, but you'll see that list of all of the other companies that have had a hand in this, or had a hand in these assets. And who here actually has heard of Inco before? Okay. See, because I hadn't, but it was it was explained to me in a way that I felt like I should have known who Ingo was. They're big. Yes. Yeah. So this particular area of land was originally held by Ingo, and they were probably essentially gifted the land during a military dictatorship that was happening in Guatemala. So sometime in the 60s, they acquired these huge tracts of land where there are lots of indigenous people living. And as the operations have been ramping up, they ramped up, I think, around in the 90s when things were quite bad, and so the operations had to stop. And just within the last few years, again, they've been starting up operations. This is primarily a nickel mine. And because of that, there's been a lot more violence. And so this is the community that we met with. The community is called Lote Ocho, or Lot 9, and that brings you back to the, you know, parceling off plots of land to be handed away, but their community is still called Lote Ocho, or the indigenous name for it is Agua Caliente, or hot water. And what happened here is, in 2007, the members of this Mayan Quechí community were forcibly evicted from their land because the company was going to be starting up operations again. And in Guatemala, unlike Canada, there is absolutely no recognition of indigenous land rights. You know, as flawed as the reserve system is that we have here in Canada, at least there's some sort of recognition of these titles of the treaty process. In Guatemala, they're seen as squatters on company land. And because of that, in 2007, they were given this eviction order. And of course, they didn't leave. This is their traditional territory. This is their land that they've been farming for centuries, them and their families and their descendants. And the mine personnel, as well as police and military, burned their homes to the ground. And obviously this is an extremely traumatic process for them. And as I said, they didn't go anywhere. They kind of retreated into the forest for about a week or so, and came back out and started rebuilding, because what else do, right? You start rebuilding when something has happened to you. And shortly after that, the mine personnel and the military came back again. But this time the men were off in the fields, tending the fields. And there was actually, again, there was more, their burnt homes were burnt to the ground again, their livestock were killed, their fields were burned, as well as there was the gang rapes of 11 women in this community. Now, I mean, this is obviously a terrible thing to even think about, let alone talk about. This woman, Rosa, she's one of the women that was gang raped on that day. And at this community meeting, this is where, you know, they're telling us their story. And this structure actually is the one structure that's rebuilt in the center of where their community was. They were still living off further in the forest because of the fear that they were feeling. But this meeting that we held was in the middle of what was their community. And Rosa is telling us, you know, telling us what she went through, and being there on that ground with them, and them, you know, looking you in the eye and telling you what happened to them, and hearing the fear in their voice, knowing that they could come back any day again. We hear rumors that the company is going to be starting up operations again. They don't have very reliable forms of technology, so there's a lot of rumors in the community. And again, this is where a lot of neighbors and communities are getting pitted against one another, and which is impacting their ability to stay strong, or not, actually I shouldn't say it, not impacting it, but making it challenging. But you still see that, you know, the community meeting was talking a lot about how they needed to stay strong together, because they were all there fighting for the same thing, which was their lands. You know, the one man was saying to us, we have nowhere else to go. This is our land. Our parents are buried here. Our parents gave us this land, and so we're not going anywhere. And just thinking about that, You know, they're not armed or anything like that. They're peasant, you know, small scale agricultural workers, right? But they're willing to risk their lives for this. And so this is the other case that's advancing to Canadian courts. And I think why a lot of this maybe has gone unheard. I mean, it is coming to the forefront a little bit now. I don't know if anyone has been hearing about these things. But, you know, we have a tendency to feel very disconnected from things, right? Globalization is making us a bit more aware of the fact, you know, all these interconnected links. But when I found out that these were Canadian companies that were doing this, that our governments and our industries are supporting this, I needed to find out more. And now that I've gone and I've spoken with these people, it's made it that much more real and connected to my life, because, you know, it's not, when I talk about these 11 women in a remote community in Guatemala, they have names now, right? These are women that I've met. I spent the entire day with them. We sat and we talked about you know, what they were experiencing. And just to feel that fear and to know that I had some part in that, while not feeling personally guilty, I felt a personal responsibility to at least be you know, sharing that knowledge. And So talking about the extent of our involvement, actually I'm gonna skip this one, but basically Guatemala went through a 36-year civil war where there was a mass genocide and a military dictatorship, and the current government has ties to that. So when we start talking about, you know, democracy and corruption, that's the type of context that they're looking at in Guatemala. And, oh, my header got messed up. That's okay. So this is just a snippet of the investments of some Canadian institutions in just two companies. So that's the Gold Corp. Gold Corp is one of the biggest players, as well as Tahoe, which is a relatively brand new development, but is also like a child offspring company of Gold Corp. So again, you start to untangle a lot of this. But the one I want to point you the most to is the Canadian Pension Plan, right in the middle. As well as, you know, lots of individual investments and things like that. And so when you look at this, you start to understand a little bit why the government hasn't been taking major action on this. There has been some pushback and some, you know, campaign work to try to, you know, step up the human rights accountability and, you know, to hold companies accountable for human rights abuses abroad. But a lot of the policies have been kind of pushed aside and saying, oh, no, the companies, they have their corporate social responsibilities policies. You know, we're going to work with them to develop their community consultation, instead of recognizing the real issue, which is that they're listening to the companies because our economy is heavily dependent on these companies doing well. And as long as human rights issues and environment issues and social issues come secondary to profits, they're going to continue to be secondary to profits, and anything that gets in the way of that is going to be difficult to talk about. But what I basically want to get across is that, you know, these, again, it's that idea about distance and that we're not so far away, and that we are personally benefiting from this. Now, I don't say that to make anyone feel guilty, but to recognize that there are these global connections that are happening in our name and in our favor, And part of why they're so powerful is because we don't really understand how we're connected. And part of that is intentional, right? I talk about the different layers of subsidiaries, the jurisdictions. When you look at the legal structures and the financial structures, they are very convoluted and very in favor of the companies. And the economic clout goes along with the legislative clout, right? But what we have to do as citizens is, it's difficult, but match that with people power, right? And especially the Canadian pension plan. The only mandate of the pension plan right now is to make profits for the pension plan. But at least something like that is potentially where we can start, to say maybe we can collectively redefine that, you know, these should be investments made in our interests as well, which encompass more than just profits. And I'm not sure, I think that might be my time, but I want to point you as well to this, and we can continue to talk as well, but there's a lot of information about this and it can be kind of overwhelming knowing where to start. But I did want to, and I told Jim that I'm more than happy to share this presentation with you so you can have all of these resources. But a great place to start is the films, and a great way to engage other community members. You could, you know, potentially hold a screening or something where you can hear the stories of these people firsthand for yourselves as well. But I also want to point you to the divestment campaign as well as the Open for Justice campaign. The money thread in this top one, the money thread is a campaign that helps you find, what investments you have are tied up in these companies, and to try to, you know, at least talk with your financial advisor, with your bank, and at least start asking questions about where your money is, so you can take responsibility for yourself. I make it sound easy, but I know that it's not, because I've been trying to find ethical investment options and it's very difficult to find, but it doesn't mean that it's not possible. And as well as the Open for Justice campaign, which is continuing to petition and lobby the government for responsible policies around human rights abuses abroad and holding Canadian companies accountable. They've met some roadblocks, but I think each wave of processes are gaining more momentum. So definitely, if you're interested in this, I would point you to plug into that so you can stay in touch with the communities that are trying to advocate for this. So, I think that's my time, right?
Well, comments, questions? His hand went up first.
I was just wondering if you could email us that page so we could have it printed out and have those resources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely can. Or I can
send it to Jim and he'll deal with it, right? Okay.
Yeah. I don't want Canadians to feel any better after your presentation, but people sometimes wonder, my being an American, they think I'm pretty anti-American. But if you'll look at the history of Guatemala, the U.S. has been totally behind the dictatorships and the genocides and so forth. And I don't think there's any country in Latin America that the U.S. hasn't been on the wrong side in terms of supporting these governments. And I think we need to call it what it is. It's American imperialism. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a nasty word and people don't like to hear it, but that's what it is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you're dead on with that, and I think the thing for Canadians to recognize is that we often think that it's the Americans. The Americans are always doing the bad things, right? And we like to think that we're not implicated in that. But we also had a hand in supporting these same military coups, the dictatorships, all the way on up to what's happening right now. And so we've been there side by side with the Americans, not in as big of a role, but we've definitely been supporting it alongside as well.
Yeah, thank you so much for this presentation. There's been a lot of information, but also mm-hmm. pointing us in the direction of how we can help. I was wondering again, what was the figure that you mentioned right at the beginning about the percent of mining companies owned by Canada?
It's around 75%. It might be, it's around that number anyways.
Okay. Yeah. Because I've been taking notes. I need the right number. Okay, or approximately, anyway. I was thinking about the problems of these being called Canadian companies and how actually companies are committing crimes in other places and here, too. But anyway, in other countries, they're called Canadian companies. And the Canadian government actually isn't getting the benefit. It's really private. You know, there's some benefit to the government, that's true. But that nowadays, too, we're seeing land in Canada being sold up for oil and potash rights and probably others. Mm-hmm. In a sense, we're setting up for being Guatemala in a way, because any of the rules and regulations we set up for the environment or the treatment of labor and so forth can be considered barriers to free trade. Mm-hmm. And South America is part of the North American Free Trade Agreement, and these things are considered mm-hmm. barriers to free trade. So anyway,
yeah. I like your comment, but one thing I would say is that it's not so much that we're setting up to be Guatemala, but actually it's the other way around. We're helping Guatemala be set up like Canada is, and I'll explain a little bit about that. So going back to the 75% of companies, a lot of it is, often there's, there'll be like a Belgian company registered in Canada operating in Africa, right? And when you start to dig into that, you realize it's because of our financial and legal structures that have been tailored to the industry over our colonial history. And so a lot of these are full-fledged Canadian companies. A lot of them are just registered here to take benefit from the tax incentives and things like that. And the industry, and also in a supporting role, the government will say that it's because we're a world leader in expertise around mining, but it's more so about the structure that has been set up to let them flourish and essentially do whatever they see fit to make those profits. And just as if you're interested in the legal or financial structure at all, I highly recommend the book Imperial Canada Inc. It really digs into that. But what we're doing is through a lot of even now development money, like foreign aid, is going to help developing countries rewrite their mining codes and write them in the example of Canada. And so I definitely agree with what you're saying, but I would just add a footnote on that it's actually we're exporting this model to countries, but we're benefiting from countries that are in chaos, that have corruption, that have lax laws, because we can we flourish in that environment because you can work with the government. They're democratically elected. Meanwhile, there's a lot of corruption going on, but they can just say, well, that's that country's problem. It's their laws, and we do whatever we can to follow the laws that we're accountable to, which is part of the problem because the international laws aren't around human rights and things like that aren't very binding. So that's part of the problem as well. But they benefit from as well as contribute to that as well. And I'm just going to back up to that slide. You can see that when the Civil War ended in Guatemala in 1996. In 97, there was a rewrite of the mining code. The royalties went from 6% to 1%. They didn't have to pay any taxes for any of their machinery that they brought in. And so you see that the ground was set for this right after the Civil War. And when the country was basically in a stupor from suffering a mass genocide that, a lot of these things were happening under their noses. And a lot of the people that were involved in this are in power. Like the president, who has ties to the military regime. I read that he actually was like the military representative to the rewrite or to the peace accords. And through the peace accords, this mine, you know, the foreign investment angle came in as well. So,
okay, last comment here, Carol.
No, she just answers it.
Okay. I don't know about you, but I don't know what to say. Boy.
It's heavy.
But I could say knowledgeable and spoken from the heart. Thank you very much.
Thank you.